The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
I'm George Chen.
And I'm Paco Romaine.
And you're listening to SlepDoc, a show where we discuss and dissect documentaries chosen by our guests from the worlds of comedy, film, television, and more.
Today, we're talking to the filmmaking team behind the HBO docuseries Heaven's Gate, The Cult of Cults. Director and producer Clay Tweel and producer Shannon Riggs chronicled the three-decade-long saga of Marshall Applewhite and Bonnie Nettles, also known as Do and T, who recruited scores of people to their alien religious cult. That's right, alien religious cult. Interviewing former group members and family left behind, the four-part series goes beyond the headlines of this little understood group that ended in a mass suicide.
And our guest Clay Tweel is a documentary director, producer, editor who's worked to include Make Believe, Print the Legend, personal SlepDoc favorite Finders Keepers, which we will definitely talk about in this episode, Out of Omaha, The Innocent Man, and Gleason. His features have been distributed by Showtime, Netflix, and Amazon Studios, and we just learned stars as well. So,
producer Shannon Riggs is the co-founder of Parkside Films. With Clay Tweel, she produced Gleason and the Innocent Man series. Shannon was an independent producer working across narrative featured films, branded content, and music videos. A participant in the Sundance Female Filmmaker Initiative, Shannon is honored to be a member of Women in Film and actively mentors emerging filmmakers. Welcome to SlepDoc, Shannon and Clay.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I have one. I got one question to open this up, and this might just end everything. Shoot. Are you two aliens?
I mean, we're all made of stars, really. Okay. So, made of stars on stars.
Oh,
yeah. Hey-o.
There's a theme here. We have a theme.
Try to get that stars money. Maybe.
Do you believe in aliens? Do they exist?
I do. I think it would be pretty egocentric to think that we're the only sentient beings in the universe. I don't know, Shannon, what do you think?
Yeah, I think anything's possible. That's kind of my motto for most things.
Have you seen them? Have you seen a UFO?
No.
Okay.
I when I was young, I felt like I saw one when I was like 10. But it was, you're young. It was very short. And I don't know for sure.
Where?
In front of my house. It was like in front of your house? I grew up in Charlottesville, Virginia. I remember looking up at the sky. And like, this was like at dusk one day with a friend of mine. And we were like, saw something moving around and very, in a way that an airplane could not move. So who knows, man?
Yeah, exactly. Who knows? I think I love alien cults. I love the cults that have something to do with aliens. Those are my favorite. Of all the cults, those are my favorites. George, do you have a favorite cult genre?
I was thinking about how we interviewed Jody Willey very early on in the show, and we were talking about Unarius. Do you guys know about Unarius?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They made their own films, and they had one of them like somehow worked on Star Wars or had access to some of the same technology. So they made like a very early film of their belief of the aliens coming down and, like a caveman interacting with aliens. And they had like pretty good special effects for like the late 70s.
One of the more interesting things for me in digging into Heaven's Gate was like understanding just how prevalent UFOlogy and the interest in UFOs was in the 70s and how just like claiming that as part of your sort of belief system brought a lot of people and brought a lot of attention, brought a lot of interest. And it was crazy, like I think the Raelians, and there's a ton of very small groups that started with or got attention because of the UFOs.
Right. You mentioned Chariot of the Gods, right? In the film that's mentioned. And I remember that's like a pretty big one. I mean, there's so much that sort of comes out of that book, I think. Like an idea about like kind of like ancient aliens and pyramids and all that stuff.
Oh, man, that's a part of the first episode where we battled forever to try to just like squeeze it as much as we could, like try to chop it down. Yeah. 'Cause you could do 50 minutes just on that.
Here's one that a popular one right now, as far as theories go, is the simulation theory. I'm like, how can you believe in the aliens and the simulation theory at the same time? To me, they seem like they could be exclusive, you know? I don't know if you know much about the simulation theory, but
I do. Oddly enough, the glitch in the Matrix.
Yeah, it's great.
Asher's, that's the Campfire and Ross Dinnerstein. They produced both of these.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, we've had Rodney on the show before. I really want to talk to him about Glitch in the Matrix too. But yeah, aliens. Okay, well, I was going to say there's a through line I think between the films of yours that I've seen, which is this series, Heaven's Gate and Finders Keepers, which is sort of like taking something that you could on its surface just look at as like a sort of a morbid, you know, or pre-meme, like 90s, that there were memes kind of, but this was like a meme almost of its era, the late 90s. But then kind of like digging into and having a lot of empathy for the people that are involved. And I think that's what I kind of gather is like an approach of yours. I don't know if you're very conscious about thinking about it that way. Do you want to speak on that? That empathy part?
Yeah, Shannon and I talk about this all the time, you know, complex characters and trying to understand essentially like why people do what they do leads you towards trying to find the humanity in everybody, whether they're the quote unquote antagonist of a story, like, you know, in Finders Keepers, John and Shannon, you can find lots of faults in both of those guys, but they're also eternally human in their flaws and in their vulnerability in which they talk about themselves and the situations that they were brought up in. So, I mean, I'm just trying to find a story and trying to find some way to present a story that is allowing the audience to connect to the people that you're seeing mm-hmm. on screen. And, like at a very core level, just trying to like foster that connection.
Yeah. I was thinking about how there is like this another thing that you do that I really enjoyed was the music choices. And I think anyone who's seen the film, like they're sort of like it's very funny. In my mind, they're very funny, but they're not like totally, you manage to like not make a joke out of the whole thing, which is like ultimately it's about like a bunch of it's like, you know, 39 or I didn't realize that until I watched this, that was more than 39 people. There were the people that went after they saw what happened and they're like, I'm still going to do this. So like there was sort of these pretty I liked the use of do you use Leslie Gore, You Don't Own Me as one of the outros. And I was just like, man, that's so on the nose in this really like dark way, but it's like it adds there is something funny about some of this stuff, but then you also have to balance it out with like kind of seeing like the family members and how they're dealing with it. Did you think about like the humor in this when you started working on it, or what attracted you to it? Was there some element of that?
Sure. Shannon, do you want to comment on the music? I mean, we talked about it a bunch.
Yeah, the music thing was a big part, but I would say needle drops in general are very, very important to Clay. And you actually have a really interesting theory about it, Clay, that I think you should talk about.
Oh, sure. I know what you're talking about. One of my many theories, that like people bring, their own sense of emotion and nostalgia to any song. So like, if you put in score that's brand new, or you put in a sound alike to a needle drop, then people don't have that emotional connection to be able to say like, oh, I remember when I was in eighth grade and I loved that song and I used to drive with the windows down. Like there's all these things that are connected to these songs and these memories that everyone has. And so you're sort of playing off of that and piggybacking on their people's emotions by using these songs. And so I, like, I've in my career, I've done it both ways, where I've tried to save some money and, you know, take things out, and then things don't land as well. And so I really fight hard if you know, like, I try to be conscientious about it, but also use the songs to greatest, like, emotional impact.
Do you guys so even start? Go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, so even if you only hear a few notes of it over the end credits, which is the case with some of the songs in Heaven's Gate, you still leave the episode with your own emotional baggage that you're carrying from watching the episode as well.
And I would imagine it helps tie in everything. I mean, there's thematic usage for songs, right? Where you're trying to tie in a theme or button it up at the end or put it in a nice bow. Do you guys start with like a list of faves and just go like too expensive, you know, or like, is that how that works? I've never heard I like needle drops. Is that, that's like where the song comes in, right? That's the editing where the song comes in.
I don't know where needle drops came from. We just started like organizing on our drives over the years, like score and needle drops. And so that's what needle drops are, like popular music, and then score is its own thing. But
I love it. I love that word, needle drops.
I focus on music a lot. I probably, when I decided like, yes, this Heaven's Gate is going to be the next project we're doing, the first thing I did was go to Spotify and start making a playlist of things that could be, you know, that could have heaven in the title or evoke my memory of being, you know, finding out about the group in 97. Mm-hmm. I started to compile a list probably of like 40 songs just within that afternoon.
Did you consider Cake Going the Distance? That's like a 90s song to me.
No, I love that song though. Yeah.
Clay, I'm going to put you on the spot. We're making a 15-second doc about you seeing the aliens out front when you're 10 years old. What is the needle drop as we go to black?
Oh, my goodness. 10 years old, so I'd be 91.
Oh, so much good music. Oh,
is Nirvana in yet?
91, like, yes, 91.
That's the year of Nirvana.
Yeah.
Like, Paul Abdul would be your other option.
Yeah, I mean, DJ Scat Cat should be scoring that scene 100%.
As we fade to black, what do we hear? Besides just a young Clay scream.
Yeah, or like Green Day. I don't know. That was Nirvana, probably. Something like Man Who Sold the World was something we had on our list that I would have loved to use.
There we go. You did it. You're hired, kid.
Yeah, thanks.
That's awesome.
So now in the process, were you pitched this idea or did you pitch this idea?
So Shannon and I had just finished Innocent Man with Campfire and Ross Dinnerstein. And as we were finishing that up, we were like in the office and Ross was like, hey, we just got the rights to this 10-part podcast done by Stitcher. And he's like, I think you'd like it. I mean, Shannon, we talked about on Innocent Man, the community that we were profiling, the town was very religious. It had some like religious themes and that we talked about throughout the couple years it took us to make that. So Ross knew we had a tendency to be interested in that kind of theme. And we listened to the podcast, thought it was really interesting, really well done. And also found out that there's some surviving members. And I think that Shannon, you can talk about this, but like Frank and Sawyer were sort of the heart of what we liked.
Yeah. So being able to actually listen to the podcast first was a good way to know that we thought that it could be a series because there were so many things that you wish you could see while you were listening to it, which is always a good sign that it's worth exploring, which is also a question that we ask immediately. Do these materials exist? Can we get our hands on them? And so then that was the next step for us, was to ask, let us see, you know, like what archive there is, what audio there is. And we started digging through that and felt like it was a good project to take on.
So you shared research with the team that made the show, which is Glenn Washington's a host, Pineapple Street's also one of the producers on that. Yeah. So that's interesting. So what the company got the rights to the podcast. So, right, this is sort of like a thing that happens. I don't know if people know in like traditionally, like if someone wrote like a story about some weird thing in like an alt weekly, that person would end up getting a producer credit or something if there was a film made of it. I don't know if this is like a common, I just learned about this a while ago, but is that sort of the case in this sort of situation?
I think so. I mean, you know, the produce, main producers of the podcast also got credits and, you know, sort of did their own deal and were able to, you know, be involved with the IP that they helped generate, you know? So, and they were great. Producer Diane Hudson, who worked on the podcast, also came out in the field a little bit with us, but also had developed a lot of those relationships with these people who, over the years, over the last 20 years, don't feel like they've been treated the best by the media, family members and former members who've been either made fun of or their story framed in a way that was divisive or, yeah, just sort of making fun of them. So facilitating that relationship and being able to start the project and know like, okay, well, we can talk to these people. Diane has told us that we have access to these materials. We have access to these people to tell those stories again on camera. Was very reassuring and gave us a good base from which to like good base of knowledge to start from.
Nice. Yeah, there's so many characters to keep track of when I was like trying to like write some notes down about this. I'm like, well, like firstly, there's like 40 people and then the main group and then all the people that are survivors and, you know, family members of survivors. It's like so much to keep track of. I appreciate that you also brought in a lot of people that were like experts or more like from the sociological or anthropological angle about cults. And
yeah,
I think that was a great context to bring. And yeah, just because I mean, I think there was like a lot of, I feel like there was some criticism with the Nexium film about like how there wasn't as much of that contextual stuff. And it was like so much centered on people that were like, kind of like trying to like build up a little bit of a case for themselves of like, you know, that they were like, oh, I got out, I'm a whistleblower, you know, kind of moment. And that wasn't the case in this case, obviously. But yeah.
I'm also very aware of just putting expert talking heads into documentaries, because I feel like that can be super dry and be like, unless they're dropping some sort of really acute knowledge that is landing and resonating in a powerful way, it usually throws me off a little bit. Mm-hmm. But the fact that the sociologists that we talked to either A, infiltrated the cult themselves, or B, were in cults themselves and had personal stories to relay in order to like, or met some of the, you know, had personally counseled some people that got out of Heaven's Gate. Mm-hmm. So I try to make it as organic as possible. So it's not just like, I went to 10 years of extra schooling and I know about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were you very interested in cults before this?
Not particularly. I think, you know, I have a, I'm curious about belief systems and religion. Like, I really loved the writings of Lawrence Wright, who did Going Clear, that book about Scientology. He also did The Looming Tower, which is about 9/11 and Al-Qaeda. And I was thinking about both of those books. They're some of my favorites, but really both of them are the same story of how our ideology starts in a pretty benign situation, a benign set of beliefs, and then usually due to human ego gets perverted and evolves in a drastic way and ends up completely different from where it started. And that fascinates me. And so you see that in Heaven's Gate over 22 years. And so I didn't even know that Heaven's Gate lasted for 22 years. I just knew the 97 suicides and figured it was only around for a couple of years. But in listening to the podcast and understanding, like I said, the culture of the 70s breeding all these types of groups with this type of UFO ideology attached to it, I thought it was fertile ground for a story and understanding that evolution.
It seems so very California when you like to me like 70s California is just like surfing, long hair, drinking on a beach, and being in a cult, right? I mean, you grew up in California, right, Shannon?
I did. And that is in part what made me interested in the project, is I had such a vivid memory of this happening. Because I grew up in Riverside, California, but I was in Los Angeles by the time this happened. But it was everywhere. It was in the news everywhere. And it was made out to be a joke, as we all know, and the Nikes and all of that. So when I heard the podcast, I was so interested to learn this other point of view on it and to hear the stories that they never talked about back then. And I think that's what really caught my eye. Yeah.
So did people hear about Heaven's Gate pre-97? I mean, it seemed like it was kind of under the radar, not something that many people knew about nationwide until the mass suicide, when it was just cemented on the news.
I hadn't heard about it before the suicide, but now that having made the show, so I've heard stories, and some people have said, oh yeah, you know, and that they had heard about it or knew somebody or had a family member who had shown interest. But at the time, I hadn't heard of it.
Well, there was this big explosion of media attention in 75 and 76. And that, I think, you know, got national news attention. And then they went underground for a while. But there was a made-for-TV movie by a guy named Gary Sherman called The Mysterious Two with John Forsythe. It was based on T and Doe proselytizing in, like, the late 70s. And that was on, like, an NBC movie of the week, Sunday night movie. And so that is on YouTube. You can watch for free.
What are we talking, like 77?
It was shot in 78 and then came out in 80.
Perfect.
It's great. And we interviewed Gary Sherman. That did not make it into the show. It's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really, I found it super fun to watch.
I can only imagine who the supporting cast was in 1980. It's like Farrah Fawcett, it's Gary Cooper.
It's a guy who played Freddy Krueger.
Oh, yeah. Robert England.
Yes, Robert England's in it. Oh, and one of the guys from Chips is in it.
Perfect.
Yeah.
It delivers. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Sounds like it. Nice. That's awesome.
Mysterious 2 was a film that I made. I've just always been really interested in strange things going on. And I came across these several articles about two people who called themselves Bo and Peep, and they were going around and collecting followers.
The Mysterious Two is a great B movie with John Forsythe playing Doe, and I guess Priscilla Pointer playing T. And T and Doe, when they found out about it, I don't remember a specific thing that they said about it, but I know they didn't like it.
I thought that, you know, I could fictionalize the Bo and Peep character to the point that I could really make a strong statement about cults. And for me, that was the real thing, is there's always room for desperation in your life, whatever that desperation is. And when somebody comes to you and has a remedy, a prescription, a pill for you to take that's going to get rid of that desperation, you'll swallow it.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
We're just talking about how, like, there's this sort of stereotype about the 70s cults that it is like, kind of like a free love counterculture thing. And this was like counterculture, but kind of like early asexual, like pride in a way. I don't know if that everyone identified that way, but that's part of being in the group, is it's very, you know, even just when I think about like this description of like, well, they were a couple and they went from town to town. I'm like, they're a couple? I'm like, no, they weren't that kind of couple. They were a celibate couple. I'm like, okay, so they were like,
it was like a business
romantic
partnership.
Yeah, it was a very weird, I mean, not to throw my own judgment of weird. It's, I mean, yeah, it's pretty bizarre. The relationship between Perf and Bonnie T and Doe.
Yeah, there. I mean, I think a lot of this, the combining of worlds of both T and Doe's, Marshall Applewhite and Bonnie Lou Nettles worldviews, were, you know, she had this New Age background. He had this very fire and brimstone Pentecostal father and grew up in that way, but he was also a closeted gay man, and so that caused a lot of inner conflict, and I think caused a lot of, and this is my own sort of armchair psychoanalysis of it, but you know, he had a lot of self-hatred, and he was trying to, he didn't like his body, so part of the belief system that he's creating with this woman is, how do I divorce myself from this body that I loathe so much. And that was part of the core tenets of like leaving this earth, leaving, changing, chemically changing your body to be a purer, pure being. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, like it started out in a way that was not advocating for any, you know, castrations or any of the like suicides, any of the really darker things that come in decades down the line. But it was, I think the genesis of it was part of that psychology of Doe.
Right. I've seen some writing that says that they think that, you know, Bonnie, you know, T kind of like mitigated some of the more narcissistic or like messianic complex elements of Applewhite. And I mean, it seems like you guys would kind of agree with that, or
we can assume so, but unfortunately we don't know that much about T. But it does seem her daughter certainly thinks that's the case. And we can say that things did get much darker after she left. So that would prove to be true.
Yeah. And then how much they had to pivot the whole ideology, even the fact that, like, well, she died of cancer, but that's separate from everything else that's going on. Like, they had to really pivot all the time. Mm-hmm. That's also was fascinating. Like, the fact that, like, you couldn't keep track of this group because they kind of changed names a lot. And then there was just, like, wasn't it just like Meet Me on a Mountain or something like that? Like, I was like, how does that even, pre-internet, pre-like pagers, how are you like even like coordinating any of this stuff? Is it just literally like, it's a billboard at the food co-op, at the hippie food co-op?
I hear you, man. I was fascinated by that too. The podcast gets into a little bit, but I'm like, the early days of like of everyone traveling around, there's no centralized communication system. It would just be like, if you just so happen to make it to this town and see this scribbling on the wall where someone left a flyer, then you know the number to call, which is like to a payphone where, yeah, in a town where T and Doe might be, like, so
like
so
the Grateful were, Dead, yeah, it's like, yeah,
people were in and out. You mm-hmm. know, there's I remember one of the sociologists, Robert Balch, who really has kept tabs on the group for a long time, said that there was one person that like lost track of the group in the first year of its existence. And then when the group had they committed suicide, and then there was this reunion that was created, this one person like reached out and contacted him and was like, I've been looking for this group for 23 years. I'm still a believer. I didn't know what happened to them. I could never find them again. This right. is crazy.
No PR. Crazy. Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't like, seems like if I was like a savvy UFO alien cult, like hanging out in San Diego, I would just take out like a ad in like the Rolling Reader. Stone magazine,
San Diego Reader.
The San Diego Reader, Creeper magazine, you know, maybe, you know, I don't know. I feel like that's what the 70s and 80s was all about, was like magazine, back of the magazine advertising.
The podcast was their day.
They also did a very 90s thing, which was they created a satellite TV show in the early 90s. Like, all I can think about is like my uncle who had like a giant satellite that took up his whole front yard, you know, like being able to. Yeah,
we had one and we had to like, I had to get my other brothers just to turn, you know, they had that big dial. You had to turn. That's awesome. That was such a big deal in the 90s. Was like a local access channel or something out of your basement.
Yes. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Well, they also like, I didn't remember this. I kind of remember this from the time, but like, yeah, they built, I didn't realize that people that were like tech savvy enough in that group that they actually like, you know, built their own websites and built websites for other people. That's the other, like someone's got an invoice somewhere that's like from that company, like on, probably scrawled on like some carbon copy or something. I'm like, yeah, one website, $300, and then that paid for them to stay in like a mansion. Like the financial part of this is also about, I mean, as someone who has like done a lot of things for two decades that no one understands, like I don't even understand myself, like some, you know, we're all guided on, you know, we all have a hope that something's going to work out after 20 years. But yeah, like just how did they organize? Like people didn't really basically have clothes or money for a lot of the time. It's pretty fascinating that they sustained it for so long.
Yeah, I mean, their lifestyle evolved. It was like they were living off a trust fund from one of the members for many years, and then that started to run out, and then they started to do computer coding, which at the time was very novel and very lucrative. They had their business was called Higher Source. That was the name of their like LLC or whatever that they ran all their funds through. But they also were on, they literally were on the move every 6 months at most for 20 some odd years because they were constantly trying to avoid authorities and stay away from, you know, the IRS being able to track them down, stay away from families being able to find and kidnap their family members back mm-hmm. from them, which was a thing that was happening to a lot of cults back in the late 70s and 80s. So they were living in a state of a little bit of paranoia and fear from the authorities throughout, and that made them very nomadic and made their like income and lifestyle really just like hard living.
I used to be pretty obsessed with like deep programming. Like I thought when you refer to like the kidnapping, and I didn't think of it as kidnapping at the, you know, when I was first hearing about it and thinking about it, I'm like, oh yeah, like that makes sense. But it's like, yeah, I guess today in 2021, can you deprogram someone, or is it non-consensual kidnap? Like there's a lot of questions I think that come up, like with like even just like people make fun of their weird names, their OD names a little bit, but it's like, is that just as valid as and someone illegally changing their name now? Like there's sort of like a lot of questions I think that like are weird 90s, or the way that it was treated in the 90s is maybe a lot of the point of this, like reevaluating what was going on in the 90s under today's lens in a way. Like we're having this like 25 year like look back at like how did the media totally botch this, kind of like the same stuff with like, you know, Princess Diana now, or like, and we're looking at like, oh yeah, the media was complicit in sort of minimizing and dehumanizing these people.
Yeah, there's lots of parallels. I mean, they're doing this story and this and making this show. There's parallels with how the media treats people and people who have different views. And there's like religious parallels. There's parallels to, you know, the QAnon and Trump of it all, and seeing the ways in which people are manipulated and leaders are given power. So it's there's a lot to chew on. I think that, you know, Shannon and I were in discussing, we discussed this a lot while making the show, but like, there's only so much that you can really delve into. So we're trying to give little doses of a few of these things.
Is there something that happened while you were filming that you wanted, you were like, I want to make another doc series about this? Is there a tangent, a branch that happened where you were like, this could be another great doc series?
I don't think so. Shannon, do you remember anything that we...
No, I don't think so. But I will say that what has come up the most since putting it out has been the parallels to QAnon and Trump. QAnon. Yeah. And that has, and there is a series about that and now, but that's the thing that I think people have asked us about the most in relation to what we did.
I would think like doing, while you guys, and you know, let me know if I'm wrong, but while you're doing so much research on Heaven's Gates and then you equate it to QAnon, you realize that Heaven's Gates was a cult and it was kind of manufactured because of someone's identity crisis or self-loathing, and QAnon is real. So like, how do you...
Totally.
Yeah, they're wrong. I don't know why people keep asking us about this.
Yes. I mean, did you have to weigh that a lot? You know, like in your judgment?
You know, I've been thinking about making a doc about a pizza place in New Jersey that runs a pedophile ring, but I you know, still looking for it.
That could be a sitcom. Yeah. That could be a sitcom, I think.
Yeah.
It is a sitcom. Yeah, that would, I mean, just saying that, I'm like, I would fucking watch that doc. I would love to watch that doc. Seriously, because it's, I love weird Americana. I don't know if we haven't discussed this, but that's my favorite. That's a term I've come up with for it. And I don't know if there's a better one, but I love weird Americana stuff. And to me, the Pizzagate thing is part of that. It'd be true crime / weird Americana, as opposed to like Finders Keepers, which was in my mind, just classic weird Americana, or King of Kong, you know, or American Movie, or, you know, any of those kind of films.
Yeah. I like Americana too. I like sort of that dark comedy. You know, certainly for Finders Keepers, we were delving into like a Southern Gothic vibe, cause it is get morbid and weird. And, yeah, like that tone was, and working in that tone definitely helped in trying to tell Heaven's Gate.
I gotta bring up another thing I dug up about this, which is like, you really like, they're overlapping into our favorite documentary like worlds. Cause what is the connection with Billy Mitchell and Finders Keepers? Is like, Billy, there's some connection with Billy Mitchell from King of Kong, right?
I think Billy, for our Kickstarter, was generously offered to, if you donated a certain amount, I think he like was signing some autographed posters and some hot sauce.
And Statue of Liberty ties.
Yeah. Yeah, Billy did, in some small way, help us raise some money to be able to go shoot Finders Keepers.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Yeah. Did you work on King of Kong?
I did, yeah. So King of Kong was first. That's sort of what got me involved in documentaries, to give the quick origin story for me.
Yeah.
I moved out to L.A. From Virginia in 2004.
That's Los Angeles?
Los Angeles.
Listeners.
And I moved out here and I wanted to work in like the art department, be a production designer for fictional films. And I had worked really briefly on a movie that was shot in Virginia that the director of King of Kong, Seth Gordon, was an editor on. And so when I moved out here, Seth was like, what do you want to do? How can I help you? And he was like, here's Final Cut and After Effects. If you can learn these, maybe I can find you some work. I was like, cool. A few months later, he's like, hey, man, I got this footage of these 40-year-old dudes playing Donkey Kong. Would you watch it and just log it and help like help me out? And I was like, yeah, sure. So, I mean, like that began a 2.5-year journey for me of working on that movie. And it was, I mean, very few people made that. It was a very small crew. It was basically like Seth was the director. Ed Cunningham was the producer. A guy, Luis Lopez, who I've worked with many times, was shooter editor on it. I was like assistant editor, I made a song that's in the final movie.
What?
Gummy stuff.
You made a needle drop?
Gummy substances. I'm officially a BMI artist because of it, I think.
Gummy substance drop.
Still cashing those checks.
Yeah. I got a $40 check last year.
And you needed help making Finders Keepers. Yeah. Okay. All right.
But so that was, awesome. For me, that was like watching, being a part of that and seeing how people responded to like this weird low stakes, high stakes story. Of like people just love the characters and it really resonated them. There's the underdog story. And so these like just larger than life characters really struck a chord with people. And that cemented my love of docs. And I started shortly thereafter directing my own and getting it, you know, further into the world of nonfiction.
Were you at all surprised in how big King of Kong was when it came? I mean,
For sure. It was crazy. Like, we had no idea that this was going to hit in any way. What had happened was there was a DVD for our Sundance submission cut got passed around Hollywood, and a bunch of people and like agents and their assistants started talking about it. And that created this underground sort of scene for it before it had even come out. Wow. And it got a lot of attention that way. I just remember being at Comic-Con. It got bought by Picture House and New Line. And they put up a booth for it at Comic-Con in the summertime. And I just remember looking around and being like, we have a two-story booth for Donkey Kong documentary at Comic-Con. Like, this is bananas.
That's awesome.
Yeah, like could not believe it. It was it's wild to see how well that did.
Yeah, it's a classic. It's a modern day documentary classic. That's awesome. Holy shit. That's amazing. And then we, you know, wasn't there a follow-up, The Son of Donkey Kong or something?
I don't know. But was there?
There's a Nibbler doc which has some of the same people in it.
Oh yeah, there's the Nibbler one. Yeah. There is still the referee guy is in it.
Walter, yeah.
Walter. Billy's in it too, yeah. I think.
Yeah.
Somewhere on my computer, I still have a medley I made of like all of Walter's original music played on his guitar.
This is great. Oh, I love this so much. Shannon, since we're talking about like getting into film, we were kind of teasing earlier, we were talking about you worked with Spike Lee and worked on Cloverfield. Are those connected or no?
Those are not connected, but my first job out of college, I was very lucky. I'm one of the people in Hollywood who got a job off of the UTA job list. Don't know if you've heard of it, but it's this like thing that gets circulated around town, and it's a job listing, but nobody ever gets jobs off of it, is the rumor mill. But
how Hollywood is that?
Yeah, but I actually got a job off of it, and it was working at Spike's company, 40 Acres and a Mule. I was very fortunate, dream come true. This was in early 2000. And so I worked there for 3 years in development, and we made a few movies. Love and Basketball, which is one of my favorite movies, came out like the month after I started. So that was my first like movie premiere that I got to go to. It was very exciting. And I worked for a few years there before leaving to work with a line producer named Guy Rydell, who's now my mentor. And it is through him that I worked on Cloverfield, which was a few years after that.
Can you tell, this is something I've always wanted to know, and you can probably tell me, what does a line producer do? I have no idea what a line producer does.
I can tell you. A line producer is in charge of the budget of a film, but I would say in a more holistic way, they're the middleman between the creative and the money. So they do create the budget alongside the accountant and the production manager. The production manager handles a lot more of the below the line crew hiring. And then the line producer's job, I think, in my understanding of it, is to make sure that those two worlds can meet up And the creative can have what they need, but they can still stay on budget.
Oh, so it's a budget thing. The word line is confusing.
Yeah, it comes from the above the line and below the line. They're in charge of the lines.
Clever Hollywood. good job, Hollywood.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Okay, I've seen it in credits forever, and I've always wondered what that meant.
Yeah.
To be a line producer.
Yeah.
That's how Shannon and I met, was actually she was working for a guy as the line producer on Four Christmases, which is the first movie that Seth did, who directed The King of Kong. After Kong, he directed this big budget studio comedy with Reese Witherspoon and Vince Vaughn. And he was, he's a very loyal guy. He like found a job for me where I was like photoshopping things to be in a prop, you know, got me some work, which basically meant I was just like playing poker on the prop truck for a couple months. Yeah.
Hanging out on set.
And Shannon was there and that's where we met.
Yeah. And that's, did you guys come up with your first project then?
No, it took a couple years.
Yeah. We became friends then. And, I would say our first project that we did together was actually a short film called Storage that Clay directed. It's a narrative short. That's the first time we worked together.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's how it should be done. It should be met on a set while based doing nothing, getting paid, and coming up with your next idea.
Yeah.
I think that's how Hollywood works.
I think so too. Yeah, more or less.
Crew always eats first. There are rules to this stuff.
That's right. Transpo eats first.
Transpo eats first. Oh, now you just blew my mind. Transpo crew talent.
Transpo talent crew. Is that
Transpo talent crew?
Crew eats last.
Yeah.
Oh man, I just got it all backwards. All right. Because I was just telling. Oh, never mind. It doesn't matter. But all right. I was just pontificating the other day about. I was like, "There's three musts on sets. Like, know what you do." Know your lines, and crew eats first. So I just got it all back.
Transpo before.
Apparently.
I mean, if you're polite, you let crew, people do tend to let the crew cut in front of them if you are a do nothing or on set.
Right.
So Clay, you might have on, nope. He's
No, I'm saying I let everybody go in front of me. I was last because I knew I was just skating by and not doing much.
Yeah.
So there is some truth to what you're saying. You're not totally wrong.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't completely lie about that. Yeah. What year did you guys start putting Heaven's Gate together? Was just a couple of years ago that you started assembling?
Yeah. 2018, I think, is when we first started talking about it. And then we compiled some materials and talked to some of the former members and made sure we had a sense of like what the tools were that we had to tell the story. And then we went out and the folks at Campfire and Stitcher, we all went out and pitched it around town. And HBO Max and CNN, just even in the room of pitching it, like we had interest, but I think that in that room, I distinctly remember them getting and wanting to protect the tone of what we were talking about, probably easier than any other place that we talked to. Just, you know, we don't want to make fun of these people. We want to be like understanding the story in a new light. And, you know, everyone in the room was just like, yes, nodding along. You could see that we were on the same page. So that was really nice. And that was the beginning of putting it together sort of in early 2019.
I'm always wondered about this. Like, how hard would it be for you guys to make a documentary about, let's say, someone that you think is guilty, and not manipulate the footage to reflect that? Let's say you're making the next Woody Allen doc. No, I'm joking. But like, what if you thought someone was like, you're doing a true crime doc and you think someone's guilty? Like, how do you not present footage or evidence or a narrative that sways?
I mean, that's hard. I think one of the things that I think about a lot is, Werner Herzog talks about this a lot, which is taking the audience on the journey that you go on as the filmmaker in telling that story, taking them on the emotional ride. And so if I come in as thinking that somebody's guilty, I'm going to try as much as I can to try to break down my own preconceived notions in my head. And maybe I'm going to find something that makes me doubt that, which I then want to relate that experience to the audience. And even if at the end I still think that they're guilty, there does need to be some dynamic shifts, because otherwise it's just a hit piece, or it's just mm-hmm. a, you know, polemic essay on guilt.
Interesting. So would you as a filmmaker, would you take the time to turn the camera to yourself and say, hey, in the film, and like
I try not to do that. And that came up during Innocent Man too, because we're having a hard time trying to figure out how to tell that story. And
great doc, that story is insane.
Thanks. But it was hard to tell. A lot of people couldn't talk or wouldn't talk, and then so you have to find new avenues. I mean, I remember distinctly telling Shannon, like, oh, now I get why people put themselves in their movies. there's like a shortcut to be able to just like narrate something, or just to put a fine point on something as opposed to relying so heavily on other people's words.
I was going to say, I think that's one thing I noticed, like, you know, with the difference between the podcast version of the story and your version, is that, you know, you have a very involved narrator in the podcast, which I think is really important for audio, and I think helps shepherd everything along in audio, but maybe wouldn't have worked as well in this situation, obviously, because it's like one person who is like, his relationship was it that he had grown up in a similar type of group, but it didn't really have specifically to do with the individuals in this case. Yeah.
I mean, which an exercise that we did was like, go back and listen to the podcast and see where Glenn Washington was filling in the gaps. Like, we love the podcast, but you also have to see that he's tying the room together through his narration throughout. And so we're like, well, we have to get that practically from the people that we're interviewing in order to tell the same story. And we have to get it just as clear and just as concise as
do you
as
write
much
a
possible.
Script?
No, I think the way that Shannon and I work is somewhat different. We don't use a writer. We don't rely on like story producers that heavily or at all. In a lot of our stuff, it's really just trying to hash it out between the editor, directors, producers, and seeing what the story is presenting itself as from the footage that we have. I love the like outlining process and trying to you know, get the index cards out, put them on the cork board, and like, you know, I get a lot of energy off that. I love that. But no sit down and like write a script.
When you're commissioned animation though, that's got to be where you're just like dealing with all the stuff you don't have footage for, right? You're just like, okay, there's all the things we don't have footage for that we want to illustrate somehow. We got to like pin together an animation. Or I don't know did you end up kind of an imp? Because that's got to take the longest time too, right? Just getting the animation stuff queued up.
That is true. In this case, I remember Clay saying that he wanted to try something new with Heaven's Gate, like do something that he hadn't done yet in his work. And so that's where the animation came before we knew where our holes were. It wasn't decided upon once we had our holes. It was an idea that was like, we spent a lot of time trying to figure out an animation style
that could you could kind of modularly fit it in where you needed to. Okay, see.
An animation style, but also the rules for the animation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel when I'm watching docs, if it's just like, oh, they don't have anything to cut to, so they use animation, and that lessens my experience of the animation. Mm-hmm. If you're successfully able to hide that, that's when it feels like, oh, it's a choice, it's purposeful. And so we were trying to figure out, because we knew we wanted to use animation and find the right spot for it, you know, what are the rules for which when we can use it throughout the whole series? And so we were trying to make it live in this dreamscape of, you know, being inside somebody's head, remembering something, or like a memory, like a dream. Mm-hmm. And so it just wasn't like, oh, we don't have a shot of the outside of that church in 77. We're going to animate it.
Right, right, right.
I did have another kind of question related to that, which is like the deciding to structure the story. Like, do you think ahead to like, is this going to end up being 10 parts? Is it going to end up being 2 parts? Is it going to be 4 parts? And was like 4 sort of like something you landed on, or like you kind of took the your corkboard 3x5 approach and just was like, okay, we can chunk these up into 4 chunks?
The bummer news is that you do have to, they make you decide the number of episodes before you get into making the show, which is always very, yes, which is very hard. And that is in part why you see so many doc series with too many episodes.
Because they pitch it with that many or something.
Because you pitch it with that many.
Oh, man.
Is that how that works?
And you can
That's how that works.
You can go over, but going under is a is another ballgame.
It's a 36-part series.
It is Game of Thrones.
You're going to love it. Yeah. Grizzly bears. One man in the woods. Wow. So, that seems so counterintuitive.
And that's across all the different all the streaming services, that's kind of like the standard way it goes now?
I mean, that's been our experience, and that's word on the street of how it's been. But
take note, listeners, take note. Yeah.
Innocent Man was what, 6 parts? 5 parts?
It was 6.
6 parts, yeah. Wow.
Could have been 5.
Could have been 5.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I appreciate
it. I thought it was awesome. I hate to say it, but I love Wrongly Accused docs. I really do. They piss me off so fucking much. I get so mad at like those fucking stuffed shirt DAs that are like, I don't care what the evidence is.
Yeah.
We're convicting, you know? And it's like, fuck you. I hate DAs now.
Do you remember The Innocent Man well?
Yeah.
So the
we'll see.
Enough. The
yeah.
What just happened last week was the in the state of Oklahoma, they're potentially going to let people out of jail because a lot of crimes happened on native land. And so Glenn Gore, who was convicted of killing Debbie Carter, might get out of jail based on that. Whereas Tommy Ward, who we follow throughout, he's still in jail after 36 years. And I'm very convinced he didn't do anything.
Yeah. I mean, that comes across. That's that kind of stuff is Kafka-esque nightmare stuff that just kills me.
Yeah.
Like wrongly convicted. Like, I can't think of a worse. I mean, there's innocent people in jail serving decades long terms, and here I'm free and I should have been in jail a long time ago. You know, like it's just not, it's not fair. But The Innocent Man's a great doc series. It's really well made, and it just pisses me off when I watch stuff like that. I get so mad.
In small towns like Ada, the prosecutors and the police were under enormous pressure to solve 2 sensational murders.
Debbie Carter and Denise Hareway. People started calling in about Ron Williamson
and Dennis Fritz.
The town was in disbelief.
And then 2 years later, Denise Hareway disappeared.
The police charged Tommy Ward and Carl Fontenot.
She goes, Tommy, I didn't think you'd ever do anything like this.
Once the confession tapes were played, these people were guilty.
If it wasn't true, you wouldn't say it.
This is like a damn game, man.
What's that?
I don't know why they keep on me. They know I didn't do this.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
So randomly, I decided to watch this on New Year's Eve. This is like how I decided to bring in 2021. It's like, let me watch about this alien UFO cult. So it's been a couple months since it's been out. How have you felt about the response, and what kind of like feedback have you gotten about this series?
So it's been really good so far. I think people are seeing it as they're catching what we were putting down about a cautionary tale of what it's like to sort of surrender your power to a group or to a set of leaders. And I think it's been a pretty good thought experiment for people examining other religions and their own religious beliefs and how that fits into their own lives. So it's been cool. I mean, seeing the response online, people have definitely, as Shannon said, drawn a lot of parallels to Trump and to QAnon, and that has kept the conversation going, especially in the events of January 6th. Like, it's become a topic that's like ever present in people's mind, and they want to understand how people could believe those things. And then they're watching this show and saying like, oh, I kind of get it. They're connecting with people who are feeling lost or in some way they don't feel like they're connected with society. And so they resonate with this fringe group's message.
There's that one backlit interview from that you got off a newscast with the guy who's like, well, the Republican Party is a cult. It's just like on the nose, very on the nose.
Yeah.
Also last minute addition.
Great. Yeah. Shannon, how have you been feeling the response?
Yeah, it's been great. I think what I love about it in particular is that a non-documentary audience has been watching it. It's sort of it's pop culture a bit. A lot of people remember it. And that's been interesting to see and listen to people respond to it who don't normally watch documentary, or they're not using the language that we all use to talk about it. They're just like responding to the castration or the needle drops. And for me, that's been really rewarding to just sort of be able to hear how it's being received.
Yeah, it brought
out in the world.
Yeah, it's like back in, this is something from like 25 years ago. It's sort of become, it's back in our zeitgeist in so many
ways. Yeah. Yeah.
Why did it hit so hard in 97? What was it about this story that it was? I just remember it was just everywhere. Was it? What was it?
I mean, I think it freaked people out. I mean, to know that people, 39 people killed themselves systematically in shifts over 3 days is wild and intense. And so I think that made my theory is like it made people so uncomfortable that they immediately had to discard it. And the way to discard it is to make fun of it and dismiss it and disarm it in a way that was like digestible for society. And so like it's the biggest mass suicide on US soil in history. So it was just like, it was a big event. You also have the advent of like 24-hour news cycles. We're coming off the back of OJ in 95. It was like Waco, OJ, Heaven's Gate, you know, like it's a thing that you can talk about and find pundits and find write articles on for 3 weeks and fill the columns, fill the time.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. I guess too, there was footage, which was kind of weird and creepy and eerie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I still remember them walking through with the camera and the purple shrouds and the Nikes and the bunk beds. And
yeah, to Doe's credit, he wanted to be infamous and he made sure that like there was video to go along and to carry their legacy on in that way. In like a very video centric culture.
Yeah, that's wow. Well, he did it.
He did
insecurity,
it.
Man. Insecurity.
It's people, the root of ingenuity.
Is it? Is it? Could be. It's led to a lot of horrible decisions, though. You know,
like that is true.
Throughout history, a lot of horrible decisions have been launched on the battleship of insecurity.
Talking about Trump,
right?
Okay,
write that down, folks. Yeah,
that's a good T-shirt. Just a battleship with insecurity on it.
That's all I am. Climb aboard. There's room for everybody. I think. I don't know. Don't talk to me. Don't touch me. Go away. So Gleason, I also really enjoyed Gleason. Can we talk about that for a hot sec?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did that come about? I'm a big football fan. And
yeah, I mean, I remember watching the game where Gleason blocked the punt in the first game in the Superdome after Katrina. And what was that? 2006?
Five or six. Yeah.
So I remember watching that live. I also remember watching the game several years later where he had just been announced that he had ALS and he led the chant to start the game. I watched that live and being like, oh my God, it was so emotional then. And I didn't even follow the team that much. But to see how the story came to me, where there was, couple producers looking who were friends of Steve and Michelle, and they were looking for a director to come on board because they had all this footage that they had accrued over the years. And a lot of it was shot by, you know, Steve himself or Michelle or, you know, caretakers. There was a couple kids, Ty and David, who like were sort of young filmmakers who became caretakers and blended that role. But they just had covered everything that was happening in that house for 3.5 years. And they had all this footage and it was very raw and emotional. And you see like this change. I mean, Shannon and I talk about it all the time. Like what's our thing that really we're going for is like, can you see somebody grow and learn and change on camera?
An arc, a transformation.
And this was that on steroids. You're seeing a guy from, you know, peak football shape and become an invalid and not be able to move, talk, or walk. And so, that I like saw some of this footage and went down there and talked to the family and, won the job to be able to tell the family story and started filming a little bit ourselves, but also they gave us like 1200 hours of footage. And so then it was this big editorial task of like, Shannon, myself, my wife Mary was a producer on it. Seth Gordon was as well. And we were just like, how do we manage all this? How do we come up with a system that's going to be able to not, so we don't miss anything, we get through it and we can like figure out and sculpt down and find the story.
What was that system?
Well, a lot of it has to do with like editorial organization and being able to come up with a way to watch things and tag them and bin them. This is very inside baseball, like logistics. Like,
no, I love it though. I'd love to.
It's our audience is kind of a lot of filmmakers. So they're going to relate.
Well, also my buddy made a documentary and he shot about 1200 hours of like Michigan's winningest high school football coach, but he had so much footage. He got so overwhelmed. He never made the doc because he didn't know what to do with it. So this is actually kind of throwing it to him right now too.
So. That happens more than you think too, that people just to get overwhelmed. And so, I basically have a set of ideas or like themes that I think that are interesting. And so you're going through and you're logging the content for what's actually happening on the screen, but you're also logging it for like, oh, this could fit in that theme. And so you're cutting it into a theme sequence as you're watching it. And what it allows is, by the end, you've watched it and you've absorbed it so many times, it's a pretty laborious process that you have a pretty good sense of like what the best moments are, but also the themes that have the most footage that are like the deepest that you can explore. And then you can look in those theme sequences that, let's say you have, you know, in our 1200 hours, some theme sequences were just a couple hours long. Like I think we culled it down to like 50 hours, which was like our best content. And then from there, we are able to put together like a 2-hour rough cut, just based on like what's our favorite things from the 50 hours. So it's like the stair step process. The backbone of the movie was fathers and sons. And so seeing all the footage through that perspective. And then it really wasn't until we started editing it together that we saw how important Michelle was, his wife, and that like the back half of the movie sort of becomes Michelle's movie. That was discovered through editing.
Interesting. That's an interesting process. I would imagine there's a lot of happy accidents that get discovered through editing. I would imagine where you're like, that's gold. I didn't know it, you know, when you interview people, you're not conscious of like, this is, or are you, I guess I should ask you, are you conscious of like, this is a great moment? Or are you just so in that you don't think of those things at the time?
I try to be present as possible, but yeah, sometimes you bookmark things and you're like, that's in the movie. That's a great soundbite.
Must have been tons on Finders Keepers.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
But there's a book by this famous editor, Walter Murch, called In the Blink of an Eye, which I give to almost every assistant editor that I work with. And it describes his system of how he organizes stuff. And part of what he bakes into his system is the fact that there are happy accidents. You can't have a system that's so rigid that you can jump right to the word that you're looking for or right to the shot. You need a little bit of wiggle room so that you can be like, oh, I don't remember even that we had that. And that's perfect.
I was going to say, there's a pretty interesting, I think it's in the New Yorker article, interview with Adam Curtis. And he talks about like his system. I'm like, firstly, I'm just like, when from 6 years of talking to directors, I'm like, it's kind of like a metadata librarian problem. Like,
yes.
Essentially,
yes.
What you're doing is you're doing metadata for video and audio. And then, but then Adam Curtis does all this stuff. It's so like, so impressionistic and just so like dream state. And just like these just all jumble of associations. So it's really fascinating, like reading about his the way he handles like the BBC archives he has access to. He's just like,
I know.
I labeled it like red feather or something like that. Like I found red feather and I plopped in it. I'm like, red feather, that'll associate with this thing. Like the communist bloodshed, you know, something like that.
I was just talking with somebody yesterday. They recommended that I start watching I Can't Get You Out of My Head, Curtis's new doc series. So I started it last night. And oddly enough, Shannon and I recently both watched Hearts and Minds, which is like in its own way a pastiche of like just like things that fit an overall political statement, but are like drawn on just like the emotions of these images back to back.
Yeah. It's like, it's very much more like just like 20th century video art kind of vibe.
Yeah. That's amazing. Are you guys stoked that you're in documentary filmmaking when documentary films have had like a resurgence? I mean, are you guys happy about that?
I hopped in right at the right time. Gleason was my first documentary, so I feel very lucky. But so yes, the answer is yes. Yeah.
What are you guys working on? Can you tell us what's next?
We have a couple things. Yeah, we both nod. We're like,
can we? No,
okay. Yeah, there's
Pizzagate. So.
They both run production companies now.
We have a couple things we're working on, some that we can talk about, some that we can't. There's a doc in the world of the opioid crisis following some of these lawsuits against the big pharmaceutical manufacturers, distributors that we've been following for 4 years now. So that's sort of our next big one that we've been tracking very closely.
Sacklers, yeah.
You know. I won't say too much. There's
you can Google it.
Yeah. There's lots out there about them. But then, you know, what else, Shannon? What else?
We do have a Netflix series that hasn't been announced at all that we're working on, so we can't talk too much about that. But that's
and come back.
That's
on the show
exciting. We'll come back on the show. It'll be down the road a bit, but we'll gladly come back for that.
Can you tell us how many parts there are? How many in the series?
We don't know.
COVID
has thrown that for a loop.
Can you make first like Bandersnatch like documentary, like a choose your own adventure documentary for Netflix?
Oh, I would love to. Yeah.
I would love that as well.
Oh, that'd be awesome. I'd love to see a doc about the Dominion suing everybody because of the you know, the voting booth or the machine thing.
Yeah.
I think that'd be an interesting
a follow doc on Sidney Powell right now could be interesting.
Oh my gosh. She's in a pickle. What a pickle to be in. Like, oops.
Nobody would honestly believe me. What I was saying was crazy.
Come on. Well, thank you guys for being on SupDoc. This has been extraordinarily delightful. You guys have made some of my favorite docs, so thanks so much for coming on our podcast and talking about.
Of course, thanks for having us.
All of them.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Absolutely, and yeah, please come back when you when your next Netflix 9-part series comes
Let's
out.
Let's make it a 3-part interview.
Choose your own adventure podcast.
All right, well, Shannon, Clay, thank you so much, and best of luck in the future, and we'll be watching your docs.
Thanks guys.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com, recapping reality since 2015.
Our theme song was written by David Siegel, and our show was engineered by Will Scoville. Our associate producer is Nick Kulsis.
Please donate to the show through our Patreon page, patreon.com/supdocpodcast. And if you want to help us out in any other way, please just share the show with a friend.
Join the Doc Talk and check out our hot takes, pictures, and videos on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. We're SupDoc Podcast on all of those platforms.
And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
You can find Paco and George's comedy gigs, when those are happening again, on the About Us page on the site.
SupDoc is by Doc fans for Doc fans. So if you want to advertise with SupDoc, or if you got a film or opinions, or if you want us to have a certain guest on, please hit us up.
We'd love to hear from you and what you're docking out on. Email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.